Good morning, everybody. While Jay is getting me set up here, my name is Kurt Hansen. I'm a hematopathologist at Mayo Clinic. I'm professor of laboratory medicine and pathology there. And today I'll be talking about middleware and laboratory hematology. We'll be taking a break after we get done with my talk here. Hopefully about 10:45, we should be finishing up with mine. So, but do feel free to get up and have something to drink or whatever. Especially caffeine, you know, snoring is so disruptive when you're up here talking. So, well, it's a real pleasure to be here. And if I can find the pointer, oh, here it is. The laboratory director is really in a precarious position these days. I think you notice how scared and frightened he looks there. And it's really because on one side, he's got the clinicians pounding at him, obviously demanding appropriately that he provide the most accurate results possible in a turnaround time that's always less than what the laboratory is capable of achieving, while on the other side, continuing to get pushed on costs in an era of decreasing resources. I'm really not trying to imply anything about our financial or administrative people here. Just random clip art that I happen to find there. But in the end of it all, I truly don't believe that it has to be a contest between efficiency and patient care, and I hope that today we can kind of portray that a little bit. Today I'm going to be talking really about, in two phases, if you will. My first part, I'll be talking just a little bit of the background about the CVC and differential, verifying the differential count, as well as doing some modeling in a pre-middleware implementation mode, and then finishing up the last half of the talk, or at least sharing with you some of the what I call the five phases that we have gone through in middleware development and utilization in our laboratory. Just really briefly, if you look back at the history of the CVC and as it began to emerge back in the early part of the 20th century, you really note that about every decade there was some significant improvement that occurred over the majority of the 20th century. But really, over the last, and this is all in all respect to any of the hematology analyzer vendors that may be here in this room, there haven't been that significant logarithmic jumps in technology over the last 15 years or so. And the improvements that you're really seeing have been more on the software side, computer capabilities and capacities, and now increasingly decision support software or middleware or things along those lines. The differential count has evolved even in a slower pace. And if you think back to the late 1800s when the Germans were really perfecting all the aniline stains and dyes that we now use routinely within the laboratories, you can really see that there has been very little change over a course of time other than development of the 3- and 5-part diffs back in the late 70s into the 80s. Now, there are certainly image recognition systems that are beginning to emerge, but they have not found their way into a routine laboratory-type focus. Why should we focus on the CBC and DIFF? The CBC is the most frequently ordered single laboratory test that we have in the clinical laboratory. In data that I just recently saw from CMS, the CBC is also the highest reimbursed laboratory assay via CMS, in addition to being the highest volume. So it clearly gets the focus of everybody's attention. It's a very widely used test, both from an outpatient and inpatient setting. You need it 24/7. You use it as a screening tool, as a door to health in a given patient. It enables you to give you an idea about a variety of potential underlying disease process that will prompt further investigation in that patient. And you can use it not only as a screening tool, but to specifically look at particular acute and chronic hematologic diseases. The manual differential, I think, as all of you that have some familiarity with this know, that it's a labor-intensive process. It requires some highly skilled personnel. When you're doing something as subjective as a manual differential, it lends itself to subjective error. When you're only counting 100 cells at a time, there's certainly statistical problems in coming up with an accurate differential. And since it's manual, you run into data entry errors. So there's clearly a lot of problems with the manual differential. And certainly from a cost side, it's some multiples of Alexander Hamilton's that most laboratories would incur every single time that you do a manual differential. The automated differential is really geared toward not missing anything. And as such, it's really put in a precarious position because it must recognize a whole wide spectrum of white cell abnormalities, lymphoid, myeloid, acute and chronic processes, benign and malignant, pre and post therapeutic. No single cell type perfectly represents each disease process, and you cannot consistently distinguish between reactive and disease based on single cell type abnormalities. And in my experience over time, is every instrument technology that I've ever had an opportunity to evaluate has its own inherent idiosyncrasies and will either overcapture or undercapture their own unique, from their own unique perspective, particular morphologic abnormalities. But from a financial side, it costs dimes to do on a given particular case. So there's clearly, obviously, financial and from a resource side of things, advantages to pushing the automated diff as much as you possibly can. So you really come back with the challenge of in doing differentials, how do you identify the most important abnormal findings while minimizing the time for either normals or those that are only just minimal abnormal? And it really comes down to the technology versus the art of the automated differential while minimizing the number of manual differentials. And I think all of you are, I'm sure, are aware of this conundrum that the laboratory faces. We move into my next part here, which is really talking about verification of the differential. Verification of the differential can occur at various steps. It may occur directly at the instrument based on auto-verification rules that are inherent within the software of the analyzer. It may occur in the lab, whether it's a technologist, you know, manually clicking the button, verifying things, or as we'll talk more about later through my talk here in the next 40-some minutes, use of middleware. And obviously, it can also occur within your LIS system where you can also set up auto-verification type rules. As I've already mentioned about auto-verification at the instrument level, it's geared toward, quote, not missing anything. It's based on quantitative flags that the laboratory sets, qualitative flags that are established by the manufacturer, and it's important to understand that auto-verification is clearly dependent on your local patient population. If we look at what we call our Mayo Health System clinics, which are the outlying small hospitals and clinics that Mayo runs in southeast Minnesota and southwest Wisconsin and northeast Iowa, it has about a 60% auto release rate directly off the hematology analyzers. Whereas my experience at our mothership in Mayo in Rochester, and I think back to my time when I started off at the University of Michigan in the hematology laboratory with a more of a chronic or acute and chronic sick patient population, at the instrument level, about a 40% auto release rate. So there's clearly inherent differences from practice to practice. The ability to verify differentials within an LIS system is clearly dependent on the vendor or the system that you are using. Many or most have some degree of rule writing capabilities. When that happens, I think it's much easier from a laboratory perspective to meet regulatory requirements. You're pushing that aspect that you need for either CAP or JCO or whatever it might be into a group of people that really understand software regulatory requirements. You have the ability, when you have rules on LIS, it inherently has the IT support and backup that you need. However, the negatives to it is then you are very dependent on potentially non-laboratory people to write the rules and understanding where your priorities may be within the laboratory versus the system as a whole. And at least maybe I'm speaking only about Mayo, but responsiveness sometimes can be rather glacial, and certainly flexibility is not an inherent trait that I've noticed in at least our LISPO. I'm sure it's not for anybody else out there, but at least for me. Middleware. Certainly that is, I think, a great tool to be using from an auto-verification of the differential perspective. You can either garner it from instrument manufacturers. Other non-instrument vendors have products that are available. Basically, you need the ability to get information from both the instrument as well as from the LIS. And it's inherently important that you bring that middleware vendor, the manufacturer of the instrument, and your local LIS resources together to understand the interface and what limitations that interface may or may not impose. It's also very important to understand if you have middleware within your laboratory, what backup and IT support do you have to have? That's very critical. And does it mean, does the laboratory have to develop their own expertise, or is there other expertise that will be available from a central basis, if you will? All these, I think, are very important considerations that you have to take. Now, we've had a lot of experience with middleware in our laboratory, in our hematology laboratories. We started off, I guess that's 11 and a half years ago, and actually started trialing it probably a year or so before that, a system that Coulter marketed that was abbreviated as HIS, and it kind of morphed into a product that is now supported by Orchard Software called Aqueduct, and we've had that now for almost 9 years. And it's a continual growing process and understanding how to use it. It's been a very successful interaction, and I think it's been successful because it allows the laboratory to do a lot of its own simply write rules within the needs of the laboratory while having just incredible support and advice from the vendor. Rob Bush, I don't know if he's in the office in this auditorium or not, has been a great supporter of this product with us, and it's been a joy working with him. Well, I want to walk through the differential process a little bit more in detail, because I think it's important to understand this if you're to apply middleware to a hematology laboratory. The differential is requested. The first and most obvious thing is it runs through the instrument, and will the instrument auto-verify? If it auto-verifies, it dumps into the LAS and then into electronic medical record. If not, I think it's really important that a laboratory go through what we call a scan and release process. You make a slide, you take a gander at it, and you decide, yeah, that automated differential is correct, and you can release it at that point. So again, you avoid doing a manual differential, and you try to at least at a scanning perspective verify that the information from the instrument is correct. So if it is correct, it releases into the LIS, and if not, you move on and actually do a manual differential, which would then ultimately come through back to the LIS and the electronic medical record. So that's really the process that you go through in the laboratory, but I really want to break down this last one just to make you think about it a little bit different. There's really two things within that manual differential bucket. And that is, you may be doing normal differentials or those that are only minimally abnormal. I think as a laboratorian, we have this tendency that you don't want to miss anything, and if there's anything even slightly abnormal, you've got to document it and report it, et cetera. I think that we also have to put on our hats and go, what is the clinical value that's out there, and what information do our clinicians need to have? And therefore, you need to be thinking about that manual differential really as two different types of cases, if you will. So those are the green boxes really highlight the four actions that may occur within your hematology laboratory. And from a middleware perspective, the two orange boxes, the scan and release, and your normal or either minimal abnormal manual differentials is really where you can gain by using middleware to get those cases out of the laboratory in a routine way and save your effort, your manual effort, more for those significant abnormal cases. I think it's really important to understand this because before you go into a middleware process, I think you really have to be modeling your laboratory and to understand your practice so you know what your gain will or won't be. There's always the tendency from above to push and say, you're going to put in middleware. That means you're going to save X number of FTEs. Well, that's all dependent on what your practice model really is, and that will really help determine the value that you will get from the system. If your instrument auto-verification rate to start with is at 80%, you're not going to get much gain out of a middleware system. Whereas if it's 40%, I can almost guarantee you that you'll have value by implementing a middleware type process. Do you have a scan and release process? If it's at 5%, that either means you're very efficient or you haven't bought into that concept. If it's at 30%, again, You've got a lot of potential within your model, if you will, to see gains from a middleware system. And from a manual differentials, how many have a true value added by morphology from a clinical basis? Not just do you identify abnormalities, but what's the important information that the clinician will get from you? I had saved information back from 1995, when pre-middleware implementation, along these type of lines. And back then at that point, when we had done the modeling prior to our first implementation, we had, as you recall, I had stated earlier, about a 40% auto-verification rate. And quite a few things were had either normal or minimally abnormal manual differentials, and we had a scan and release process. If we look at what we do today, we have over 80% that are released through either the instrument or the middleware auto-verification, with the difference really being pulled from that scan and release bucket as well as the normal manual differentials. And you can see that only about 10% of the cases that really come into the laboratory do we, or 10% of the cases that come into the laboratory do we do a manual differential on. So understanding your practice ahead of time is really critical in setting expectations for outcomes. I also think it's really important to understand the value equation during this modeling process. The value equation, as you know, is quality over cost during a particular episode of care, quality being defined as either patient or physician satisfaction, actual outcomes, direct patient outcomes, patient safety and error issues, as well as service issues to both the physician as well as to the patient. And this value must drive the process of how middleware should be used. Obviously, cost is the first one that comes to everybody's mind. You reduce cost, you will increase value. But I also will be sharing with you today some things that I think will really, how you can use middleware to improve quality, which will also improve the value that you provide back to your clinical practice. Well, that's the first half of my talk. And as I look at my time, I think we're doing well here. I now want to share with you kind of the what I call my five phases of middleware utilization that we've gone through in our laboratory. First one, as I start from the bottom, is the easy one, the automating rules for manual differentials. I want to talk about something that's very dear to my heart, which is focusing on patient safety issues and how middleware can be helpful in that regard, how you enhance laboratory effectiveness. I think Jay did just a fabulous job pointing out a variety of ways how middleware can really help drive the effectiveness of the laboratory within a practice. Talk about some issues relative to supporting management goals. And in an area that we're just getting started on that we should have done before is really helping us understand how to unify a multi-site practice, a multi-site hematology laboratory type practice. So if I start with the first one I really want to talk about is just how to automate rules for the manual differentials. And again, focus is on these two buckets. Again, you model your practice, you know your practice. That's the areas where you focus on writing your rules to drive those two things down. And it's pretty simple. You simply write rules for what the technologist does. The technologist looks up results in the computer, if they compare results to previous studies, if they base a decision on whether to do a diff on where the patient is or what kind of a doctor the patient is seeing, do you minimize or ignore certain results or certain instrument flags? In other words, what are the algorithms that a tech goes through in deciding whether that sample at that point in time gets auto-verified or gets a slide and a manual differential gun? So it's really kind of it's a simple process of understand the thinking, the algorithm, but once you get that, it's easy to write the rules. What are the sources of information that you need to have as you write these rules? The simple things account for the vast majority of the time when you write rules. It's the quantitative numbers coming off the instrument. It may be based on gender and age of that particular patient. It's the instrument flags. Delta checks are great, but they're also difficult to write. Delta checks may be based on absolute numbers. They may be based on percentage differences. Delta checks can be used to either hold a sample within the laboratory. Delta checks can be used to release samples into the laboratory. You can use delta checks on the instrument flags, if the flags changed or not over a given period of time. A lot of people talk about using middleware rules to write rules specifically for a physician. I don't like that idea, because I think what it does is it ingrains into your system an individual physician's idiosyncrasies that may or may not be medically valid. I would rather write rules for groups of physicians for a particular specialty or for a particular disease process as opposed to an individual physician. I guess I'm lucky at Mayo, we have enough numbers, I don't have to worry about dealing with an individual, I can always revert back to the group. So I know in smaller institutions where you may only have two oncologists, it may be difficult in trying to ignore this by physician or to get around that physician idiosyncratic behaviors. To do that, what we have done is we have more than one type of CBCs, and you'll see some of that as we go on here. We have different kinds of CBCs that clinicians can order that will give back different kinds of results. And again, I'll talk about that as we go through. You can have rules by where a laboratory is located, where the patient is located. You can write rules for a specific individual patient, which I think is a very powerful tool for middleware. And also, obviously, time. How long is it, when's the last time that the patient had this kind of a particular result. So there's a whole bunch of sources of information that you really have to access to effectively write the rules that you need within your laboratory. Now, I'm not going to walk through these, but there's a variety of academic papers out there and other sources that have established or proposed guidelines for rulemaking. The International Society of Laboratory Hematology has published, and it's available out on their webpage, a set of consensus guidelines for establishing when a microscopic slide review would be done. So in other words, you can use those rules that are out there from the ISLH and actually use that as your basis for writing rules. Those rules may be based on age, it may be based on the component of the CBC. You can see that sometimes it's just a one-step type process. Other times it's a two or a three-step type rule process. It may be based on the component of the differential, and again, what steps may happen. There's a large list from the ISLH relative to particular instrument flags that come up and what you should be doing, and again, it's layered out into primary, secondary, tertiary type information to write those rules. Our rules that we have used within Aqueduct are very similar. I'm just going to point out a couple things a little bit more in particular to kind of give you an idea about how some things to think about as you're writing your middleware type rules. If I look at this first one, for example, the flag here is it'll trap or keep a specimen within the laboratory if a hemoglobin is less than 6.1. And importantly, what we've used middleware to do here, we've allowed it to, and I know a lot of LIS systems will allow you to do this as well, will actually allow the rest of the CBC and the differential to be released while you trap only those components that you believe may be affected by that particular aspect. And again, I'm not going to go through what all these different CBCs are, but suffice it to say then, we've got different kinds of CBCs that we say that rule applies to all those CBCs as well. So you can see how you layer the various rules that are on there. Likewise, instrument flags, and again, it releases either the CBC, none, or the five-part diff. I got one error here. I see it may trap the entire five-part diff, and it is to which CBCs does this apply to? Delta checks. I'm going to just kind of show you one that we use kind of in a unique way, and it points out that if you start asking your techs what problems do we have and ask them to come up with solutions, it's amazing what you may come up with. One of the problems that we had was that we had samples that would be clotted that would make it all the way through the system and get auto-released only to get a call back from that clinician and say, this is impossible. Mrs. Nelson is totally healthy. There's no way that she can have these kind of results, et cetera, et cetera. And what we found was that, as crazy as it seems, when we look back at several hundreds of these over a period of time that we had collected, if you actually put a delta check, that if a platelet count, and you had a previous one, that if it was plus or minus 80% of a previous sample, then you knew it was okay. But if it was plus or minus 80% over that percentage, you knew that you were dealing with a potentially clotted specimen. So it was a although it sounds crazy, it's been a fabulous tool for us to be able to use and identify potential clotted specimens. So again, different ways to think about how to use the rules, et cetera, et cetera. Now, as I go in and give you kind of some of the outcomes, if you will, of our rules that we've written, I need to lay out the structure that we have at Mayo, which may seem a little cumbersome at first. We have a 12-story laboratory building that we operate on. And down on the bottom, and of course they call it the court level instead of calling it the subterranean basement. But in the court level, they have the phlebotomy area, and literally right over the wall is our highly automated central clinical laboratory where our hematology analyzers are. And of course they put it in an area where there was no way that you could put the rest of hematology right next to it. And indeed our hematology lab is 8 floors away. Now, luckily there is a transport system that takes on average about a minute and a half to go from the basement up to 8th floor, and it's actually worked out well because this is where our bone marrow area is and our other complex hematology laboratories are. Well, how the system works is that the outpatients come over here, get their blood drawn, the specimen flows through. There's a small chemotherapeutic laboratory that turns out results, and if they have problems, it comes back to the central laboratory. Our two big hospitals have a couple stat laboratories. The main patient flow and any overflows come there. And then we got some regional family practice clinics that operate in a similar type fashion. So you can sort of get a feel for how the funnel goes. Certainly there are CBCs that occur and get verified out there, but the main bulk comes through that main laboratory and then up to us. As I was putting this talk together, I just grabbed the data from that particular day. Usually we see somewhere around 2,000 to 2,200 specimens. This was over spring break, and so there weren't as many docs around, so our volume was down just a little bit, but we had like 1,700 CBCs came into that central laboratory on that particular day. 1,400 of them were auto-verified either through the instrument or through the middleware system into the LIS and then into the EMR. On the rest of them, then the 315 came up through the hematology laboratory, and they were all trapped by the middleware for a variety of reasons. And what's that, 671 different flags were generated on those 300 cases, with approximately half of them being instrument flags, the other either being quantitative or flags on the CBC and differential type basis. Well, of those 315, we always rerun the things because of that hop over the wall from the phlebotomy area to the lab. Sometimes the specimens are too hot, they're too warm. I don't know what, the cells haven't stabilized yet. I'm sure there's some scientific reason, but we have found that when we just simply rerun, there's a certain number of them that will just go ahead and auto-verify. I think it has to do with membrane stability over time. 105 were scanned and released, and the remaining had a manual differential that were done. So this kind of gives you an idea of the workflow and the modeling that can occur if you use a middleware in your laboratory. Again, 18%, 82%, and again, these 18 break down into that only 10% of the cases that came in of those 18 or those 1,700 had manual differentials that were done. And within your manual area within your laboratory, whether it's 8 floors removed like us, whether it's 8 miles removed or 80 feet away, whatever the distance might be, you can see about half the effort went into manual differentials and the others were in less manual type activities. What's the impact of that? If we look at, again, the numbers I shared with you earlier, our pre-middleware impact or modeling that we had within the laboratory and our current model, after we implemented back in 96, we actually led to an immediate decrease of 3 FTEs within the laboratory. We saw our turnaround time of our priority ones or our stat CBCs went from 50% to 85% being released within 30 minutes. Obviously, that's because you're not doing nearly as many manual interventions. You're going directly off the instrument. Our overall turnaround time dropped dramatically because of that aspect. And the average CBC time currently in our central automated laboratory is actually always less than 20%, and a lot of the times right around 10 minutes. So it's that middleware has really driven, both from a cost as well as a service basis, improvements to our practice. I'm going to throw out something different out there to make you think perhaps a little bit differently about the CBC, and that really relates to those patients that are getting chemotherapy. And what we've done is we've really applied different rules for patients receiving chemotherapy for myeloma and lymphoma and certain kinds of leukemias. And the reason being is because the entire clinical question is different for these patients as opposed to the patient who's walking off the street, going seeing their family practice doc, or going into a clinic pre-surgery or whatever it might be. And the question is very simple. Are there enough platelets and neutrophils so that the hematologist can continue to give chemotherapy that day? It's a really simple, specific, straightforward question. Too often in the laboratory, we think about CBC as a test, when in reality, it's a multitude of tests, all having different purposes. Our job is to try to find, can we hone in and try to create a different CBC for that unique, specific patient population? So we created a CBC, different type of CBC, available only to the hematologist, called a CBC-C. And it's important to know, and they know, that this is no longer a screening assay, it's a therapeutic monitoring assay at this point. And to them, an accurate differential is not a concern at that point. Just what's the neutrophil and platelet counts? Is there less than 20,000 platelets? Should I hold the dose of chemo today? Are there 1,000 neutrophils or 2,000 neutrophils? I know the patient's neutropenic, or I know the patient has cytopenias. I just want to be able to give that mixed dose of chemotherapy. Small abnormalities that the laboratory usually hones in on and gets very, you know, is very diligent and aggressive about, really are of no concern to the clinician. And the main thing really being is that they need that rapid turnaround time to get their patients through the chemotherapeutic type unit. Now, as you can see, we have really broad rules. You know, before we trap something, somebody's going to have to have really abnormal CBC before we trap that specimen. Indeed, for the most part, the reason specimens don't get auto-verified on these are really based on core instrument flags that really say, hey, this thing's really bad, we can't do this. It's really very important that the clinicians be continually reminded about what the role is of this. Every year, as new docs come and go, I send out a note to them saying, okay, here's a reminder, this is the only way you can use this assay, et cetera, et cetera. And it obviously puts the pressure back on the clinicians that they know that they can only use this test for certain scenarios, and they have to call the laboratory to create a real CBC if the clinical indications are such. Oops. Again, I look back in my files and was able to pull back some information. In the pre-CBC day, we were seeing about 150 CBCs from the chemo unit. We were auto-verifying through Aqueduct only about 35%, and remember that our auto-verification rate probably at that point in time in 2001 was maybe about 75%. So there was a big difference for those that auto-verified versus those that didn't. Big difference in turnaround time. This is where I got the vast majority of phone calls from unhappy clinicians was like, I need my result. I need my result. You know, you're backing up my whole practice today because you didn't get me a CBC and a differential. So we collected the data, put it through the system, implemented it in 01. We're currently at almost a 90% auto-verification rate with a 20-minute turnaround time. We audit this on a routine basis to see what's the clinically, what's going on, and indeed we find cytopenias, and we find other abnormalities that are clearly there that would be very important on a screening test, but are irrelevant from a therapeutic monitoring side of things. And we get no more than one CBC a month that's really converted to a routine CBC. And more importantly, I get no phone calls. Next thing, I want to focus on what I call patient safety issues. Why call it patient safety issues? Thank God in the heme lab, we rarely have true primary sentinel events. They do occur, but they're pretty rare. But we do create revised reports, and they do contribute to unnecessary clinical steps, which in turn may lead to unnecessary patient events. Most laboratory directors are only remotely aware of all the revised reports that go on in their laboratory. It's sort of like an out of sight, out of mind. You're only aware when some clinician is irritated enough that they actually call you about something, and you tuck it away and go, it must have been a bad day, and you move on. But if you start collecting that information, every lab director should be surprised at how big that iceberg really is. And instead of pointing the finger at why did Bill forget to do that, it's why did they happen? What was wrong with the process? And until you collect that information, I guarantee you will always underestimate the severity of the issue. Why do we have revised reports? Well, usually the most common thing that we have found is a revised diff count after we've reviewed a bone marrow, a subsequent blood smear, or a call from a clinician says, I don't believe that result. Something is wrong here. It's a revised platelet count due to how we used to have those clotted specimens that I was talking about, how we use the Delta check versus EDTA associated clumping. Again, based on a subsequent interaction or from a phone call. We all know about the sticky notes that are everywhere in the laboratory and memory. And it's like some techs you really value. Why? Because they could remember 15 different patients and why they were difficult to do. And other technologists don't have that capability. You have technologists that don't follow through SOPs. Again, a memory type issue. They did a scan and release instead of doing a diff. They forgot to have a second review by a senior tech or by a physician, and the list goes on and on. The memory type issues. We have manual reporting clerical errors, i.e. putting in a direct interface. Mixing up slides and paperwork unfortunately occurs very rarely, thank goodness due to barcoding, et cetera, et cetera. Well, this led to our asking the question as we looked at these revised reports and processes is how could we use middleware to help reduce these revised reports? And we quickly came to realize that individual patients act like individuals. They don't always follow the rules of the group. And we're going to call our patient Mrs. Johnson. We're a good Scandinavian state, you know, and therefore Mrs. Johnson will be the one that we talk about here. And it may be that Mrs. Johnson's acute leukemia, the blasts on follow-ups will be missed. She has lymphoma, and circulating lymphoma cells. Lymphoma cells get mixed on follow-up. She may be difficult to interpret if it's a monocytic type process. Those things are inherently difficult. You don't want to, if once you've identified a platelet clumper, you don't want to miss it again. Likewise with agglutination. Sometimes there's something very unique about Mrs. Johnson that you want to carefully follow. Sometimes particular protocols and clinical trial requirements demand that you do particular things. So there's always the sticky notes, if you will, that you need to overcome. Middleware, we have found, this is probably one of the best values that we talk about a value, for, you know, the value equation of quality over cost. This is one of the highest quality things I think we've really done within the laboratory, is immediately when we find one of those situations, the lab can create a rule to trap the next sample that comes through from Mrs. Johnson. We apply a timeline, whether it be a 1 month or a 3 month or whatever it might be, and it doesn't matter where in the system Mrs. Johnson walks into, whether it's the clinic, the ER, one of the outlying clinics, etc., Mrs. Johnson's specimen will be trapped, and we will look at it. Now, I don't have a lot of data here. This is more anecdotal from what we feel within the laboratory. But I do know that pre-establishment of what I call the Mrs. Johnson rules, we were averaging about 2.5 A events per month. And an A event meaning a very serious revised report that likely could have, might have, didn't necessarily lead to it, but might have created some serious clinical outcome concerns. And again, we were communicating by email and by sticky notes. Post Mrs. Johnson, without a doubt, has made an impact because our number of A events, whether it's due to this specifically or is it probably in part due to just more awareness of patient safety type issues. We have 5 to 10 Mrs. Johnson rules in place at any given time, and it takes less than 2 hours from a request from one of our bench techs to one of our people in the laboratory who writes these rules very simply, boom, it's live. So we may identify it in the 7 o'clock run, and if by whatever chance another sample gets drawn later that day, it will get trapped within the system. I found that to be a very powerful aspect of middleware within the clinical hematology laboratory. Now, Jay talked a lot about how you can use middleware to enhance laboratory effectiveness. My stuff here that I'm going to talk about is not nearly as sophisticated as Jay, and I'm probably 15 steps behind what they're doing, but I'll point out a few things very quickly so I can hide a little bit here. But clearly using middleware to streamline the presentation and flow of data from the instrumentation to the instrument to the workstation, regardless of where that data was acquired. Again, 80 feet away, 8 floors away, 8 blocks away, 8 miles away, whatever it might be, you can have that data right there easily transmitted to you. In other words, minimizing that number of manual steps from that instrument to that microscope workstation where your tech is trying to make a decision. And this really does blend in with that patient safety issues that I was just talking about. You can use that, as Jay mentioned, you can use the middleware to make the lab paperless, and I think that is, techs will love you for it. They hate the paper. They always got things mixed up. This is one of the most powerful, wherever you are, whatever it might be, this is clearly one of the big benefits. Transmit scatter plots. You make the CBC and DIFF data easily available. You can use color coding, as Jay pointed out, to aid visual recognition. You can see why rules were invoked in particular situations, et cetera. Now, this is just what a tech might see while she's sitting at her microscope, and the sample had come up from the main laboratory. They had rerun it, and it comes, and you see, this is basically one that's already been released. You see the normal scatter plot. You see the normal CBC and DIFF, and over here I think that says auto-validated, it's been released, and that's what that might look like. Here's a sample where you look and right away you see where the scatter plot's abnormal. The stuff that's gray is the stuff that's been pre-transmitted to the clinician, so the clinician right away within 10 or 20 minutes will have the WBC and the rest of the CBC and the platelet count available to them. The stuff in yellow, again, color-coded, easily visible, you know, doesn't, you know, takes a nanosecond to tell where the abnormality is, says this is the stuff that's been trapped, and if you look down below, it says why has it been trapped? It's because of a particular flag on an instrument, and we've written it such that here are the particular rules, or here's a particular course of action that we think you ought to be doing based on this scenario. So again, you can start to see the power of how not only transmitting the information, but what information you have available, how easy it is to see it, is all very critical. You can have a middleware system that does this, but if you can't easily identify some of these things, then it really loses its power, and indeed you may increase your probability of making mistakes. Here's another one, same thing, really abnormal scatter plot. Trap the whole darn thing. It tells you why, and it says what? Platelet clumps and interference, and it says repeat it, make a slide. Check everything, basically, is what it says. And you note there's a green box. The thing that's lit up here says comments. Now, I realize later here on the next slide, this is actually on a different patient. I got my slides mixed up. But, you know, so this is a different patient. But the text can leave comments instead of emails or sticky notes as to, hey, this is what we know about the patient. This is what's happened in the past. And, again, an easy way to communicate regardless of shift, time of day, day of week, etc. Other things, the lab can continue to run even if the LIS goes down for 2 hours on a weekend for its quarterly or annual maintenance. The lab keeps running. You can use rules as SOP reminders to the techs. It's difficult for techs to remember everything these days, especially as you increase their responsibilities. We have some related to new employees of what they can and can't do as we try to help in their training period. And some things may need particular doc review. So again, you can light up your SOPs into this process as a reminder to your techs as to the actions that they're supposed to do. And likewise with particular disease processes. Jay also talked about how middleware can be useful as a QC manager. This is something that I clearly want to do and should have done but have not done. A lot of instrument QC packages for hematology are stuck on the old 1-2S rules and the Levy-Jennings plots, you know, et cetera, et cetera. This is clearly not an optimal QC package for a hematology these days. What it does is you end up with a high false rejection rate, which really breeds a tremendous amount of complacency within the laboratory, such that techs really minimize the importance of doing controls because, oh, yeah, they're out, we repeat, and they're fine, and you move on. And why is that? Well, the reason is if you actually look at the sigma metrics off your key components of the CBC, they have tremendously high sigmas. These are very good tests. And this is, I'm sure that this is certain, this is the same regardless of the instrument manufacturer of, you, of the big platforms, you're going to all be in that same kind of range. So therefore, you really ought to be doing a 1/3.5S, 3.5 standard deviations instead of 2 standard deviations. You will really drive down your false rejection rate. Your lab will be turning out better results. But again, you can't do it at the instrument. The LIS usually aren't that flexible. And again, can you use your middleware as your QC manager? I think it's really important. I want to briefly talk about how you can also use middleware to help support management goals. Basically, is there laboratory information out there that can be that can't be gathered through routine reports? We have been using it to look at technologist productivity, type of cases that are released by the technologist. We use it to look at how has the system operated within the last week. You can monitor utilization rules. When we started out, we were using this all the time, looking at particular scenarios as where we could write potentially new rules. So I think, again, very powerful to understand your, again, modeling your practice to understand what the power is. Now, this is in a given month. I can't remember what month this was. I grabbed like 30 of our, we've got like 35, 40 people in our laboratory that does not only CBCs, but also bone marrows and body fluids and all that kind of stuff. And as you can see, if you look at the, if the average is about 40 smears per shift, and as you look, you go, wow, we've got some great performers. Who are they? Well, these are our supervisors that kind of come in every once in a while. So I clearly kind of, hey, what's going on here? But you can also kind of identify some of these other, some of these are new people, some of these are not. So, you know, from a management side of things, you can really get down to a level that the LIS doesn't necessarily provide you. You can also take it to the next level and remember the two steps that a tech really does in the laboratory from a manual side of things, quick scan and release, or you do a manual diff. Well, as you sit and look here, for the most part, it should be like our average in the laboratory is about 2/3 manual, 1/3 scan and release. And I just pulled off the 6 or 7 high performers here. And as you look at it, you can see that these two gentlemen, as it turns out, clearly have inverted their ratios of manuals to scans as compared to everybody else. And indeed, they're being lazy and not doing using the appropriate SOPs and are scanning and releasing instead of doing a manual diff. The supervisor has talked to them. This situation, this is a relatively new employee who you can see is really not using the scanning methodology. Why? Is they not comfortable? Are they not aware of it? What can we do from a training side of things where we can really help that individual come up to a higher level? So again, how can you use middleware from a management side of things? This last one, unifying multi-site practices, is really more one of our future things. Again, it's something that we should have been doing long ago, but we just simply haven't. Whether you have, these days, most people, it seems like you'll have multiple sites within a hospital or a clinic. You may have multiple hospitals and clinics within an organization over regions, local, regionally, nationally, whatever it might be. You may have different instrumentation, different clinical needs, different patient characteristics. Not all of the sites may do manual differentials. You may or may not have a common EMR. It really varies from organization to organization. I really believe, and I think Jay really showed this as well, is that middleware offers you that common language through which laboratories can communicate, and it really may be a starting point for standardizing, at least how you do your as I'm talking about hematology here, standardizing your hematology practice. In conclusion, before you purchase or implement, I think it's critical that you model your practice to understand where you might benefit from middleware and to what extent. Keep in mind the value equation. Cost may not be your only source of reason to do middleware, but also quality. Envision how you might coordinate your instrument LIS and potential middleware system to play in your practice. In some places, it may be that your instrument and LIS might be sufficient, and actually middleware adds a layer of complexity that really won't help you that much. You must work with your IT people to understand their needs and basically what kind of support your laboratory might need. Again, we went through our 5 phases, which may not reflect for everybody at least, but I wanted to be able to share that of whether you automate the rules, and that's the easy part. Clearly, I believe you can reduce costs and improve turnaround time but you can also clearly improve employee satisfaction. They don't enjoy flipping through the computers and flipping papers and et cetera, et cetera. They want to do what they are hired to do and what their skills are. And clearly by doing an automated, releasing more automated diffs, I think we improve our accuracy. I do hope I've challenged your concept of the CBC and the diff, and that how you may want to think differently about specific patient populations, whether they be screening or monitoring type processes. I believe it's very important to focus on patient safety issues and looking at revised reports, and how can you use middleware to fill in those gaps with patient safety. And again, to echo what Jay said, to enhance your laboratory effectiveness, supporting your management goals, and unifying your multi-site practices. You know, I had, since I started with this, I got to end with this. Here's our laboratory director. All of a sudden, he's much better looking. He's lost his glasses. He's all content. Everything is in order. He doesn't realize he's about to be crushed with everything around him, but he's a little oblivious, but he's a much happier individual. So I want to thank you. This has been very fun putting this together, and appreciate your attentiveness. And I think we have some time for some questions before you all wander off for break. Questions? Yes. Yes. Well, sometimes the question is why would you want, what's the difference between auto-verification at the instrument, the CBC analyzer, versus auto-verification using middleware? Your instrument itself comes with software that has, I think, limited abilities to auto-verify. You basically auto-verify on either quantitative flags, and you set your parameters for hemoglobin within a particular window. And if it's within that particular window, it releases. Otherwise, it doesn't. And likewise with instrument flags. If you have instrument flags, it doesn't release it. So what you're able to do with middleware is, in addition to that core information that the instrument would use for auto verification, it can pull other core information from your LIS. It can pull location. It can do delta checking. It can put combinations of things together that even if you have this particular instrument flag, but if your quantitative flags are this, you ignore it. Or in other words, it can layer rules that your instrument can't. So you think of your instrument auto verification as a first pass, and that middleware adds on a definite layer of ability to add multiple layers of rules into the process. And that's what you could. We run it all through the middleware, however best works for your system. Question, yes? The question is basically how can you use middleware to help you with critical value reporting? Yes, you could. We don't. We have a separate methodology about how we handle critical callbacks, but you certainly could. You could certainly set it up that you identify those patients in a particular unique way that would, if your lab, our laboratory doesn't call back any of the critical values. We have a separate unit that does that. But if your laboratory is the one that's doing your critical callbacks, you could use it to identify that unique population. So certainly you could use middleware in that regard as well to help you define that. Question, yes? Well, Jay's coming up here. It was certainly easier for us to go to a vendor that had a particular product, because it limited the expertise that we had to develop within our laboratory. I don't know what Jay might say.
Yeah, we also buy. The only exception was the one case I showed where we developed our own with the web product. But you know, these are very sophisticated products, and oftentimes they have to interact with another vendor. So it's sometimes even a partnership. I can just cite one example of that. You know, we have data innovations for some of our rules processing, but we also have that linked into the Bio-Rad server. So that's certainly something we bought. But it isn't just buying it, it's implementing it. I think a lot of the expense is from your own IT team, you know, doing a lot of the real work and implementation for your system.
Fully agree. Other questions or comments? Oh, yes. I can't hear. I'm sorry. I'm a little hard of hearing. You may want to go to the microphone, would you please?
Dr. Jones, you have this collection of middleware solutions. So you don't have like one application. You need in one lab or one particular functional area. You created an application or bought another application to solve that problem and use the LIS as like information highway to connect it. What's your overall, over time, you have this, so many applications, have these data islands, what are you going to do about all the, they're going to integrate?
Okay, well, I'm not sure if I heard the last part of that question.
You have this, all these small applications, which is all creating small data islands for you.
Right.
How you're going to integrate all these things to come up with some unified decision-making and outcome process?
Yeah, that's a growing problem I alluded to. It's costly in terms of maintenance. You have to have the right fields, the right message content passing back and forth. So the future, as I showed in one of my slides, is to try to put it in a consolidated bucket. That doesn't mean you have to buy from one vendor, but it has to be so easily interoperable that it's not a maintenance nightmare. So it's a tall order. I don't think there's any real easy answer for what you're asking. I think it's an astute observation you're making, and hopefully we can fix it before it gets much worse, so that we don't just have a few islands, you know, that develop into an archipelago.
I mean, I may be off, but it would seem to think that software seems, I mean, everything seems to go in waves or cycles, and you would, I think up to this point, I have not seen a tremendous push from some of the major LIS players out there for really pushing these kind of solutions at the laboratory type level. But I think I'm starting to see or hear or read more about that. So I would really envision, I would think, to see that more of some of this being more in your centralized LIS perspectives. And you see things kind of go, you know, when there's a gap or a hole, you fill it with something. And then the marketplace catches up and tries to pull some of that in, and then you see, okay, what's the niche or the market that's still left, and you keep moving that way. So that's how I would hope to see that this thing eventually evolves. I think that's what you were getting about with your, you know, some of the coordination between vendors and LIS people, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
You know, it seems to me like take a software kind of model, like when you have Microsoft, you have this whole operating systems, and all these individual vendors bring this little tools.
Yeah.
And Microsoft says, oh, yeah, that's good. Let me pull that into my OS, and then it becomes mainstream kind of things. It seems like in certain way, either the LIS vendors one day going to say, oh, yeah, that application has a good use of it, a lot of people using it, let's pull it out in the LIS, or something like you see the other model you're talking about, it is the next level of CIC, things and bringing all these things and creating something middleware integrated application. I don't know which way is the right approach to go, but if you have any thoughts on that.
And I know I mentioned the other time about how the LIS vendors need to probably evolve over time, and instrument vendors will also have, and they certainly are. What we're seeing is that there's an evolution of their thinking over time about how to bring this into their products, you know, et cetera. So there's a, you hope that the marketplace, again, will eventually catch up with what the needs really are here.
Yeah, I think there will likely be partnerships between middleware vendors and LIS vendors or EMR vendors. And you know, there's some big companies that have kind of come into the diagnostic industry lately that I think have a real stake in all this happening. If you look at a company like Siemens, that's looking not just at integrating LIS, but also RIS and pathology systems. So I think the future is more and more going to be integration, and you need to have that interoperable tool, that tool set, to make all this happen. Otherwise, we're just going to be frustrated that our applications won't really integrate. Okay, were there any other questions, or is it time for a break? I have 10 of, let's meet back here at about 5 after. So that gives us about a little over 15 minutes.
Thank you.
Oh, so was yours. It was, wow.